I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Philip Hoare is the author of 8 nonfiction books. His most recent is Rising Tide, Falling Star, In Search of the Soul of the Sea. Philip Hoare, welcome back to the program. Always good to see you.
It's great to be back.
Now, you've been described as having a lifelong fascination with the sea. So do you remember when that fascination began, or just has it always been there?
Well, it's kind of ironic. I was born in Southampton, right by the sea, and I was so scared of it. And I really link that back to this memory that I actually don't remember, a memory I don't remember, of my mother growing up as a little girl in the house that her father had built for her, and a big bathroom with a big bathtub, a big Victorian bathtub. And along the side of this bathtub, her father had painted a great big spouting whale. And I never saw that. You know, it's a story my mother told me, but it somehow induced this kind of fear of the water, the monsters that lay beneath there, to the extent that I never learned to swim until I was in my late 20s. So it's quite a... And, of course, there's a good reason to be scared of the
sure.
sea.
Sure, yeah, lots of stuff in there.
I was swimming in Cape Cod Bay at 4:30 this morning.
Oh.
And I would only swim in the dark when I really know the terrain, right? I know what lies underneath what Herman Melville called the ocean skin, this, you know. And that kind of... But for me, it's that fear that makes it exciting, the sense of mortality. I swam with a friend at Coast Guard Beach yesterday, and there's a big sign saying... Swim at your own risk. There may be sharks, jellyfish. Keep clear of seals. And nothing's more inviting to me.
Oh my goodness! Wait a minute. You found somebody to go swimming with you this time
I
of year?
I did. Oh, my friend goodness. Mary Martin. Yeah.
Wow.
She bravely joins me in our.
And we should say, regardless of the season, you swim every day, either here or in Southampton.
Every single day.
Wow. Now,
every single day.
I do you wear a wetsuit, dry suit? Do you?
Nope.
No.
Nothing.
You must not stay in very long. I can't imagine. The hypothermia would set in pretty
quickly.
Yeah, quickly.
I mean, you know, yes. There's, you know, you realize that it's time to get out when all sensation has lost your limbs. And you climb back. And I swam with a friend off Cornwall recently out of season. And he said, you've turned the color of denim.
Oh, dear.
And I was kind of deep blue.
So now why do you do that?
Yeah, well, there's so many things we do in the world which people tell you to be careful of. And I think we're too full of cares in our lives. I like to be careless.
Mm.
I like to have less care in my life. And we're sitting here, we're sitting at a desk. Most of the people today listening to this show will be looking at a blue screen, either on their phone or their computer. And there's a big blue screen out there, a real one, that you can enter, in which you can leave gravity. You can leave the mortgage and the car and, you know, politics. All that fades into nothing. It means nothing.
So it's like a meditation for you in a way,
it's
then.
It's totally a meditation. Yeah. It's not a triathlon. You know, I'm a puny 130-pound weakling, you know. I do it because it's a way of communing with nature. I know that sounds sort of a bit crazy, but it's true.
Yeah. So you didn't learn to swim until you were in your late 20s. So do you have memorable experiences from your childhood with the sea? Or probably next to the sea, not in the sea?
Well, my problem was my... parents were both born in the 1920s, so their relationship was, I mean, in those days, that generation really didn't learn to swim, you know. And although I was living next to the sea, the thing is, the sea where I swim customarily when I'm in Southampton in the UK is, and it's an industrial waterway. It's the same waterway which Titanic sailed down, and now container ships and oil tankers come up and down it. There's an oil refinery on the far side. It's not a pretty place. You know, it's not the Cape. When I was a child, it seemed a forbidding place, you know, a dark place, especially because Southampton has a double tide. So when the sea goes away, it just leaves this expanse of black mud, which is... it's very unprepossessing. There was no impetus to get in that water. You know, it just didn't feel like an attractive place.
So you split your time between the Cape and England. So when did you first start coming to the Cape, and what brought you here?
So I owe my introduction to the Cape to John Waters, who'd reviewed my first book for the New York Times and wrote me a fan letter actually about it. And he said, you know, I spend my summers in Provincetown, so, you know, why not come up and see me there? You know, so, and I thought, being English, I thought of Providence. I don't know where I was going when I came up here. And in fact, I'd stayed 2 weeks, and I was staying at the White Horse Inn across the way from where John was staying. And it was only on my last visit, last day in Provincetown, I realised there were whales here. And that all those childhood images of what whales were, and I'd only ever seen captives, one captive whale, an orca, in a safari, in a sort of sea world in England. And it was just, so I went out on this whale watch boat, which Dennis Minsky, my good friend in Provincetown, was working on, and just it was like this unbelievable, this idea that this huge animal leaving its environment and briefly becoming part of ours, hanging there in this kind of sea spray, you know, as they breach out of the water. I mean, it was an intensely poetic moment. I'm afraid I responded with a very unpoetic word, which I won't repeat here. But and that was, for me, it was a Damascene conversion. It was like, no, the sea is not a fearful place. It's an utterly beautiful and miraculous place.
Yeah. And although it can be, you know, tough. You write about a day when there was a storm fierce enough to keep you from swimming. And on that odd day that you don't swim, does it have an impact on you mentally or physically?
I get incredibly angsty. I really am very uncomfortable. I mean, like, I would be very uncomfortable here sitting in this studio.
Had I not been swimming,
especially because the sea is outside the window. I mean, I can sort of see it out of the corner of my eye. It beckons. I can't look at a body of water. Dennis and I were walking the beach forest yesterday, and he looked round to wonder where I'd gone, and I was in the pond with Dory, his
true,
dog.
True.
Say, Dennis Minsky sitting in the studio with us. So, Dennis, I mean, this swimming every day? You don't join him? Do you join him in the summer, maybe?
No. I do not, and I despair of it, and I walk away from it, and I'm pretty sure he will meet his end that way someday, and hopefully I won't be there.
Wow. So
that's jolly, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yes. Well, the storm that prevented you from swimming reshaped the coast. Because of climate change, we see an increase in the frequency and strength of storms and more coastal erosion. Do you think our relationship with the sea will undergo a significant change as those of us living on the coast begin to see the sea as an adversary, or some will?
That's such an interesting question. I mean, actually, I think it's already happening. That storm, which would have hit the east coast of the US as well, there were all these warnings on the news media: don't go near the storm, don't go near the sea. It was as though the sea might reach out with sort of these octopus tentacles and drag you in. And we do right to fear the sea, but as it starts to eat away at our land, as it is doing here on the Cape. I mean, it was shocking. I was last here in October. It was shocking to go back to Herring Cove with Dennis the other day. And I mean, the car park has disappeared. Mm-hmm. It's just disappeared. I mean, that's a mark. That's just a little taste of what's going to happen. I remember years ago, I was sitting on the beach with Stormy Mayo looking out to Cape Cod Bay, and we were looking up and down, and this, I mean, Provincetown, like a lot of the Cape, is full of expensive real estate, waterfront real estate, the prime real estate. And Stormy looked up and down and he said, you know, 50 years' time, it'll all be gone.
Mm.
And so I think just from apart from anything else, the economic impact. But I think, yeah, I think you're right to put your finger on the spiritual aspect of that, Mindy, because it's I often think, you know, the sea is the kind of repository of our soul. If this was a dry planet, if there was no water on this planet, obviously we couldn't exist, but just imagine that for an instance. So the sense of these deep bodies of water, you know, body of water is an anthropomorphic term, this sense of this body of water containing mystery and containing 90% of the animate life on this planet is in the sea. Mm. You know, we ignore it at our peril. I was only reading a great book about tides the other day by Jonathan White, and talking about how the Earth has actually been slowed down in its spinning. 400 million years ago, the day lasted for 21 hours. Now it lasts for 24 hours because of the tide dragging at us. So that tide drags at you and I now, Mindy, as we sit here. It affects the water in our body. We were born in amniotic water. You know, we came from the amniotic sea in our mother's womb. We first listened to the world through a salty filter. And I think for all these reasons, the sea has this great draw. At the beginning of Moby Dick, Melville talks about water gazers. Go down to Battery Park at the end of Manhattan and stand there looking out at the sea. And it's you're looking out to your soul, into your soul in a way.
Yeah. So you talked about that particularly memorable whale watch trip that you had, and you write about it in the book. And Dennis, you were there. And I imagine you see that a lot, Dennis, for people who've never seen a whale before, who come out on that whaleboat and have just a magical experience.
Life-changing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an amazing occupation, if you want to call it that, to witness that every day, people just being changed forever.
Mm-hmm.
Stormy days could be a different kind of change when they turn green and so on. But yeah, it does happen quite a bit, and it's very special to be part of.
So, Philip, you've had several in-the-water encounters with whales, some exciting, some placid. So tell about some of those encounters and how they changed your sense of self and your place in the larger world.
That's such a good observation, Mindy, because there's nothing like being in the water with an animal which might be 60, 70 feet long to put your pathetic life in perspective. And to be in the water with an animal which has complete control over the choreography of that encounter. So sperm whales, which are the whales I've swam with most, sentient, social animals, utterly connected, continually communicating with themselves, so even though they might be spread out of tens of miles, that they are always this kind of sonar moving through your body at the same time. And to see a whale like that spin around you, come as closer to me than you are now, Mindy, or as close as this microphone, and then dive down and turn on its back, because that's the only way a sperm whale can see you stereoscopically through its, you know, its two eyes, which go out to the side. But turning on its back, it can look up at you, and that sense of connection between something which is absolutely sentient. The sperm whale has the largest brain on this planet. What it uses that brain for, we still don't know. We still don't know. But you feel, and I'm sorry to be sort of touchy-feely about this, but you do feel it when you're in the water. You feel this kind of sense of curiosity. And I know Dennis thinks this too, actually, without sort of getting too sort of touchy-feely about it. But that sense of when you look a whale in its eye, his or her eye, because it's a being, it's a non-human being, it is reading you. That animal is reading you. It knows that you are mammalian. I mean, when you're in the water with a sperm whale, it's echolocating you. So it has this scan, like a CGI scan of your body. It knows how you feel. It knows the temperature of your body. If you're a woman, it knows that you're pregnant before you know you are pregnant.
How do we know that?
Well, dolphins. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, because dolphins are the most commonly kept captive cetaceans, a lot of experimentation has gone on for quite a long time now. And that's been proved that they can detect this. They will actually point to a woman's belly.
Well, I don't know if you recently I saw something on Facebook where a scientist was in the water and she had never had this happen before, where the whale kept trying to put her kind of on the fin. Like, it was basically, it saw a shark that she didn't see and it was trying to save her from a shark, is kind of the quick and dirty of what was going on. And I thought, wow, that is one smart whale. And I've gone out with Stormy and the crew at Center for Coastal Studies doing some of the research on the right whales, and I can remember looking. Now, I don't want to go in the water and swim with them. I would be a little bit afraid, but I think they're beautiful and I love them. But as I watch this one coming that looks like it's coming right towards our boat, which is not a big boat. You know, Stormy's boat is not a huge boat. What is it, about 27 feet maybe, something like that? And I thought, oh my gosh, this whale is going to No, it just veered away as soon as it got near. It was like, it knew exactly where we were. But it's amazing. So do you see that, Dennis, that the whales are kind of have a better intelligence than we might give them credit for?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I steer away from the word intelligence because it's sort of meaningless. But they are definitely aware of us, definitely aware of us, definitely move around us. often move towards us, but that awareness of us is what really interests me and what Philip and I talk about a lot. Mm. What are they thinking?
Yeah.
What are they thinking?
And saying, there was another section I was reading about where you were in the water upside down trying to listen to a humpback whale. The humpback whale is singing away and you're thinking, well, he or she's got their head upside down. Let me try that too.
That was really funny. That was off the west coast of Mexico a couple of years ago. And what I didn't realize that when humpback whales sing, because I thought you have to be in the water to hear it. It doesn't, because the water acts as a whole huge loudspeaker, and it's sort of the sound comes through the water. So you hear the sound from above the surface. But of course, when you want to be really close to that sound, you get in. So I got in and I realized that the best way to hear it was to do what the whale was doing, and it was he was hanging by his flukes up perpendicularly, pointing down to the sea bottom. So I did this, I looked like a sort of bottling seal with my flippers up in the air, and you could just feel this in your ribcage, this incredible sonic boom. I mean, I've never felt, you know, it's the deepest dub reggae, you know, it's just way beyond that.
Yeah. We're talking with Philip Hoare, author of Rising Tide, Falling Star, and Dennis Minsky, natural biologist on the Whale Watch, Dolphin Whale Watch boats, right, Dennis? 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Philip Hoare about his book, Rising Tide, Falling Star, In Search of the Soul of the Sea. Also sitting in with us this morning is Dennis Minsky, Philip's friend, also a naturalist on the Whale Watch, Dolphin Whale Watch out of Provincetown. Philip, will you read something from the book?
I will. Thank you, Mindy. Out of the blackness, obscure noises drift from the docks, booming over the water. The red lights of the power station chimney blink like an industrial lighthouse, summoning and warning. You can be what you want to be in the dark. For me, it used to be like nightclubs under London streets. Now it's another nocturnal performance. An hour before dawn, before the light starts to stain the summer sky violet, I ride back to the beach. Foxes sidle out of the woods and rabbits flash their white scuts at the approach of my bike light. High in the trees, over the shore, a pair of tawny owls converse and screeches. Crows hang in the branches, all angular tails and beaks as if they'd been born out of the bowls. All these creatures own this place in the interregnum of the dark. They should not be anywhere else. No one could have told you when you were young what would happen. They didn't dare. It's enough to realise what we have lost is still ahead of us. I see things that are not there. One magical moment, I feel like a penitent. The sea is so still, it seems like a sin to break its surface. But I do. Swimming at night with diminished sense of sight only makes the act all the more sensual. You feel the water around you. You lose yourself in its sway. Fish bite me, leaving loving grazes. I turn on my back, watching the stars fall.
Beautiful. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. For many people, the beach is a place to visit in the summer. But beach walks in the winter give us a very different perspective. So what are we missing when we don't explore the shore in all seasons?
Well, you know, and I know this is something that Dennis will agree with, you're missing a graveyard in many ways. Mm-hmm. The other day we were walking, I mean, the beach still feels out of season here on the Cape, I think. I think on our walk we saw a dead gannet, a merganser, I saw a loon as well, I think. And you see the kind of physical toll of the winter on the natural world. And that's really implicit and explicit on the shore. Thoreau, on his walks of Cape Cod through in the late 1840s and 50s, maybe, he comes across so many sort of reminders of the mortality, the toll of the sea. the shipwrecks. That he, you know, the beginning of that book is an astonishing opening to that, that his walks of Cape Cod, where he comes across the survivors. Well, they're not the survivors, they're the bodies from a ship carrying Irish immigrants across to Boston. And they're washed ashore. And he talks about Cape Codders still walking around, still foraging, you know, over these bodies. And there's a very extraordinary scene in his walk when he's walking up the back shore of the outer Cape, and at a distance he sees an object, and it's about a couple of miles away, and it gets closer and closer and closer. It's a human head. But of course, the winter beach is also so beautiful because everything has been stripped away. Even the vegetation, you know, the compass grass is spinning around. So that's why it's called compass grass, because its dead strands spin around like a compass. Everything falls away. I think winter is just the most intense season because the bones of a place are revealed, like the bones on the beach, the ship's timbers that come out of the dunes after storms. That sense of the sea rising, the sea always there, the thing that we turn our backs on, it's still going on.
There are frequent references to death in Riding Tide, Falling Star, the story of the couple perishing together on the Titanic, the necropsy of the dolphin on the beach, the graveyard of shipwrecks off the coast of the Cape. You even describe your swim on New Year's Day at Herring Cove Beach this way, quote, "Every swim is a little death, but it's also a reminder that you are alive." So if the sea is linked intricately with the human life, are we also linked to it in death?
I think so. I mean, as I say, you know, we came from the sea. I became very interested when I was writing the book in the people who've populated the Cape, the visitors like Thoreau, like Sylvia Plath, who came here, who talked about the sea as being a sort of poisonous place. She actually described it, "My final memory of the sea is of violence. A still yellow day in 1939, the sea molten, steely slick, heaving at its leash like a broody animal, evil violence in its eye." I mean, it's intense. And of course, Sylvia had actually tried to drown herself before in one of her suicide attempts. Interestingly, her mother tried to get her to go to Provincetown as a sort of therapy. She thought she might get better there, so that the place could cure her. And the one great sort of positive image that comes in Sylvia Plath's very intense poem "Daddy" is this moment where she's on honeymoon with Ted Hughes in Nauset, and they see a seal, and it's this one beautiful, calm, peaceful moment in this one line in this poem, which is very bitter and acerbic, that they just see this seal floating there, this head of this seal popping up. I think poets like Virginia Woolf, Jack London writes so interestingly about the sea. And again, he tried to kill himself. He tried to drown himself. Martin Eden, spoiler alert, the guy actually does drown himself. And it's a sensual death because it's the one death that we know about, because it's the one death that people come back from. You know, drowned people have been brought back from the dead. So we know that there's this sense of euphoria that takes over and a kind of dreaminess, and you don't care. And there's one account that I read about drowning that someone thought they started to wonder, did I turn the gas off? Who put the cat out? And, you know, these kind of, and then you just drift off. So there's something appealing about suicide which isn't messy, that you remain whole in. And I think that's why Sylvia Plath wanted to walk into the sea and just vanish, evaporate, be part of the sea. Aristotle said, Aristotle drowned himself, and he said, he's supposed to have said, as he threw himself, "I've spent my life trying to comprehend thee, now thou must comprehend me." There's that sense of giving yourself up to this body.
Those of us who call the Cape home believe the interface between land and sea and the marine life found in our waters to be spectacular. I don't think any of us would disagree with that. So what do you find most compelling about this region? And are there other parts of the world that speak to you as profoundly as the Cape and the islands?
I think because the interaction of human and natural history on the Cape is so intense. The way its inhabitants, from the indigenous people who were here when the Pilgrim Fathers arrived, also because it's part of the founding myth of America that these, and they, the Pilgrim Fathers, of course, first left from Southampton where I live, and they hit Provincetown, where Dennis lives. So I feel an emotional connection to that. But the historical sort of presence of where the sea ends. You know, Thoreau talked about a man may stand here and put all America behind him. So you standing with your back to the land on the Cape and realizing, you know, as we do, that that sea is full of life, it's there's an incredible energy, I think, about that. That powers whatever you do. You live on the Cape, you're driving, you're delivering oil, or you're working in a supermarket or whatever, you know that sea is there, and you are aware of the changing of the seasons and the rising and falling of the tides.
Yeah, I was going to say, Dennis, how many people say as soon as they hit that bridge, whether it's a Sagamore or Bourne, it's like this sort of, you know, peacefulness or something comes over them. It's like a magic.
Absolutely. We are all so fortunate to live here, and those of us who visit.
Yeah.
Too.
So, Philip, do you consider the sea your muse?
Yeah, I do, because it gives me such a... it's that whole thing about swimming, especially in the dark, or especially in the cold. You, when you get in the water, your brain is rebooted. I mean, it's like, you know, your body says, okay, you're just about to kill me. But
your body's saying, what the heck are you doing?
It does. It absolutely does that. But, you know, there's a sense of being reborn as you come back out of it. And I think any cold water swimmer will tell you that. For the rest of the day, you just feel charged by that kind of one mad moment. But the sea is so storied. You know, it's not just the animals, it's the whales and right down to the... I was swimming 2 days ago. I was swimming out in the bay in the dark, and there was bioluminescence, dinoflagellates. So the stars are above you, and the stars are at your fingers below you.
Nice,
incredible. Yeah. Those, you know, it's like John Berger, the great critic, wrote. You know, the stars are where stories began. Well, the sea is where they fell to. You know, the sea embodies so much of our myth. You know, it's the creation myth, it's Noah, it's all those things that really, I think, because we intimately know that without it, obviously, we wouldn't exist, but also that sense of the soul, really.
So how would you describe the significance of the sea to people who have never and may never lay eyes on it? I mean, they certainly have lakes and ponds, but there are people who never get an opportunity to see the sea. So how do you describe that significance to them?
Where do you start? It's quite interesting. We were on the Whale Watch about a few years ago, and there was a chap there. He was from somewhere in the Midwest, and he was older chap, maybe in his 70s, and he pointed to the buoys, and he asked me what they were for, and I said, they're, you know, there's lobster pots down there. And he said, what's a lobster? He was an educated man. Mm-hmm. He'd never left Midwest. You know, this is his first contact with the ocean. I think the big problem now is that we have to ask that question, how to describe the sea, because we are disconnected from it. And by turning our backs on it, we turn our backs on the future of our planet. I mean, it's the future of our planet. We know that much of the more severe effects of global warming have been kept from us by the sea absorbing that heat and absorbing carbon dioxide. It's been sacrificed to our economic progress in many ways. For those aspects, I think alone, the sea has a huge importance. But it's also that sense of recreation. You know, in England, in the 19th century, they used to build concrete stairs going down into the sea so you could access the sea, you could walk in. Nowadays, health and safety, they would never do that now. They would never do that.
Right.
You know, I think we are too cosseted. We are too fearful. The sea is there for us to enjoy. It's a dangerous place, but I sometimes despair the way that children especially sometimes are taught that it's a dangerous place.
Your early books were biographies: Stephen Tennant, Oscar Wilde, Noel Coward. So talk about that transition into your more recent books about the sea and connection to the water. That is quite a different type of writing.
It is. I mean, I was very interested when I started writing in culture, in art and society, and extraordinary figures like Noel Coward or Oscar Wilde. And it's quite interesting, though, to discover when I was writing Rising Tide, Falling Star, that Oscar Wilde was a wild swimmer. He was described by his son as swimming like a shark. And I think what it is that those figures, when I was growing up, I was kind of an oddball. I was kind of a misfit. I didn't feel as though I fitted into society. And I was drawn to people who didn't, you know, sort of eccentrics and people who have sort of not towed the line. And I realized that for a lot of those people, like Wilde, like Sylvia Plath, like Virginia Woolf, they saw the sea as a kind of escape for that. And so my transition from writing about those people to writing about the sea has been quite a natural one in a strange sort of way. That Rising Tide, Falling Star, I mean, Oscar Wilde pops up in there, Stephen Tennant, who's the subject of my first book. I like the sense that that people have reinvented themselves through the sea in a way.
So I want to read you something that Alex Preston wrote from The Guardian. Rarely have I read a book that felt as if I were speaking so directly, so confidentially to me. Rising Tide, Falling Star is about books and about swimming, but most of all, it does what all great books do, makes you feel that it's a private conversation between you and the author. I finished it with an obscure feeling of privilege to have been granted such access to Hoare's most secret, intimate self. It may not get the praise it deserves because some will feel it is covering the same territory as his earlier work. They miss the fact that this book goes further, darker, and more beautifully into the deep. What an amazing review! You couldn't ask for something better than that. What did you think when you saw that? This is part of a much longer article. I just took out two paragraphs.
To be honest, Mindy, I picked up that paper because I was really fearful. I knew there was a review, and there's the major. It's the Guardian, and it really makes a statement. Opened up, saw this full page review, and I just saw one word. It was the only word I needed to see. I really hesitate to say it now, but it's masterpiece. And I just kind of like went all wobbly. It's extraordinary when people get it. It's a very diverse book. It's a book full of people. I mean, I think one of my talk about the sea as a muse, but I have one person who's a muse, and that's not Dennis Minsky, although he is my muse, but actually he definitely is my muse. He's the man who introduced me to the whales and with whom I share a lot of my experience of the sea. But it's also a woman called Pat de Groot.
Oh, your landlady.
Yeah, who's my landlady, or she's my sea lady here on the Cape in Provincetown. And she's a woman whose life has been completely, I mean, her beach, her house sits on the beach. The sea goes underneath it. She's a wonderful artist. She would kayak out to the breakwater off Provincetown there and draw the cormorants. I mean, these cormorants, which Dennis always points out to people on the Whale Watch as these kind of rather benighted animals. People think of them as being sort of rather smelly, malodorous, sort of pests in a way. She draws them with her Luandru marker on a board across her kayak. She draws them as Habsburg royalty, you know, as incredible caricatures. Not characters. She also, at one point, started communing with an orca, which was briefly resident in Cape Cod Bay. She would go out and feed it flounder.
Oh my!
And draw this animal. But to me, she's part animal, really, in a way, and she's a real exemplar of the kind of people who end up, especially at the Outer Cape, you know, the very tip of the Cape, where sort of all the kind of ordinariness of the world falls away, and you get the kind of the eccentrics, the artists, the writers.
Isolatos.
The Isolatos, Melville's Isolatos, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So, Dennis, are you disappointed to learn that there's a muse ahead of you?
Not at all. I don't deserve that title.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Philip Hoare. His new book is Rising Tide, Falling Star, In Search of the Soul of the Sea. Also in studio with us is his friend Dennis Minsky, who is a naturalist on the Dolphin Whale Watch boats. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So in this book, you write about other artists and writers, which we've been mentioning here, both historical and contemporary, who come to the Cape for inspiration. Is there a common thread among their stories?
They're lost people. You know, we talk about people who arrive on the Cape as being washashores. Well, we're all washashores somewhere. And they're looking for a home, really. So I suppose it's that sense of the sea is a fugitive, literally fluid place. Because it's nowhere, as well as it's everywhere, because you don't see it, and because it's when you're there, there's nothing else you can see. And I think that's why people like, you know, there's so many people who come to the Cape, and it's like Eugene O'Neill, you know, out on the dunes, this sense of the temporary nature, like the temporary nature of habitations. The idea that, I mean, I love this fact that all new houses in Provincetown must be built on basically on stilts, you know, like with a sense that the sea can flow underneath them. That by the time you get to Provincetown, beyond Wellfleet and Chirura, that it is only sand. It's very humbling, I think. You know, even the sand dunes themselves move like the tides. The land itself is moving. It just puts all this sort of, you know, the notion of man's dominion over nature is completely undercut by this place, this shifting place. It's never the same. Just, you know, in the past winter, the way it's changed, the way that sort of movement, it reflects the way maybe you feel about yourself, about the way you negotiate the world. So I think it's acknowledging the sense that everything changes all the time.
Yeah. So some of these people you would expect to read about, I think somebody that you aren't expecting to read about is David Bowie.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about your affinity for David Bowie.
Well, he's sort of, I still can't name him in public, in a way, because I'm still kind of coming to terms with his departure, which happened when I came to finish the book, January 2016. And I remember driving down here, actually, down to Woods Hole, a couple of days before he died, and talking to Dennis about how much he meant to me and how he was my alternative education. You know, a boy growing up in suburbia in Southampton in the UK in the 1960s, he was just like this god, this other kind of education that showed you could live in a different way, and that art and music and culture mattered, that these were important things, and I think they're more important today, more important than ever. And for me, he became the great sort of, I wouldn't even say role model, because that sounds sort of bureaucratic in a sort of way. And waking up, having written the book, which begins with him as a figure, which has a strong figure right throughout the book, to see that, an email, was the first way I learned about his death. And I went out that morning and just walked to the dark beach under the stars, and felt sort of homesick for the fact that I wasn't in England where he'd lived and where I'd experienced. But then I realized that he was actually lying down in New York. You know, he'd begun another transformation. And that's how the book ends, spoiler alert, with Dennis and Dory and I walking on the beach and me writing his name in the sand.
Yeah. We should say Dory is your dog. Yeah.
My dog.
Yeah. Does Dory swim with you? I think Dory might enjoy some of those.
She does.
It's been too cold for her.
Yesterday she did, didn't she?
She did, yeah. Right. She accompanies me.
Well, it's funny because when you said that, you feel charged. That's what immediately in my mind I thought. Whenever you you throw a ball for the dog, whether it's whatever season, they kind of come out of that like just all recharged. Sorry. John is giving us a call from Provincetown. Good morning, John.
Good morning, and good morning to Dennis and Phil as well. It's quite a pleasure to hear you two on the radio together.
Good morning.
Hi, John.
How you doing? I actually wanted to call, and it's funny, I'll see both these guys probably later in the day anyways, but, you know, just to call and say it was really great to hear Phil on the radio today. I've actually have done a couple of Phil's books, read them, and one of the things I really, really like about them, I find it kind of ironic to, you know, hear talking about the sea so much, because I always feel like when I'm reading Phil's work, his feet are really planted on terra firma, so to speak. Just the genuineness of feelings whilst he's out and about, wherever he happens to be, beach, boat, dunes, wherever the scene happens to be. But to, you know, really be able to pen down into words the kind of feelings and emotions that go through one's head and heart when they're in a situation where, you know, really do spend a lot of time along either the coast or out on open water. So I wanted to say, you know, thank you to both of you and for bringing Phil onto the air today.
Right.
And to really wish Phil well with the new book. Appreciate it a lot. So
thanks,
just wanted
John.
To get that out there so people would have a chance to think a little more about Phil's.
All right.
Because I hadn't heard too many callers in. So.
Well, we appreciate that, John. Thanks for the phone call. And we also got an email from Captain Richard Bailey of Wellfleet. He says, I think of myself as a wash away, too often at sea to have met Philip. We'll look for a book or two, looking forward to some time ashore. Hello to Dennis.
Hello.
Yeah. So, Philip, what's your writing routine?
So my writing routine is entirely dominated by the sea. It's tidal. My writing time is tidal. So if, as happened this morning, the tide is high at 4 a.m., I get up and go straight to the sea. If it's not high, I start to work. I always work early in the morning, sometimes 3 o'clock, sometimes 4 o'clock, depending on spring or summer. The great thing about that is by 7 o'clock, you've done your work for the day.
Yeah. So are you getting up writing at a desk or are you writing in bed?
I write in bed.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
I write in bed. I actually don't get out of bed. You know, it's kind of, so it's that continual process. I find the things your brain has processed overnight, the kind of flotsam and jetsam of the previous day, come to the surface and you wake up with, I think you wake up with the kind of creative energy at its height. I know there are morning people and there are evening people. I'm a morning person. By afternoon, I'm dead to the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I can only really go and swim again. but I have a very strict routine. I eat breakfast at exactly the same time. I eat lunch at exactly the same time. I fall asleep after lunch for exactly 40 minutes. I wake up. I don't have an alarm. I just wake up and come back and I have my supper at the same time. Yeah. So, yeah.
Would you read something else from the book for us?
I'd love to. We turn back into the wind. The strand sweeps open and wide, connecting the inner bay with the outer sea. A beach that in summer is filled with sunbathers and anglers remains resolutely empty. I take off my clothes, no easy matter with frozen fingers and gloves, hat, scarf, jacket, fleece, two jumpers, boots and socks and jeans and long johns to contend with, and run into the navy blue sea. It rolls on and on. It looks like it did 6 months ago and 5,000 years ago. It even feels the same. I treat it accordingly, borne up, singing, as though nothing has changed, as though everything will always be like this and always was. It is New Year's Day. Dennis and Dory walk on ahead. Glowing pink and shivering like a dog, my extremities as navy blue as the sea, I struggle back into my clothes, unable to do up my jacket with my numb fingers, and run after them. Dory looks back, apparently relieved. Did she think I'd been lost for good? In the car park, Dennis has to rub my hands in his, making jokes about hoping that none of his friends will be driving by. My teeth chatter and my muscles shiver, shaking me back to life. Skin and bone burn like a hard, cold flame. And they continue to burn and shake for an hour afterwards, till my body is convinced that the threat is over. Every swim is a little death, but it is also a reminder that you are alive.
Do you ever wonder sometimes, Dennis, if he's coming back from those swims?
I'm not kidding. I I am supportive, but I think he's crazy. Yeah. Just go on record, crazy.
Yeah.
I do wonder, yes.
So you're also teaching creative writing in Southampton. What's that experience been like working with students?
It's great fun. I generally teach MA students. They're kind of sort of a bit mature. And there's this great, I mean, there's a great sort of burgeoning boom in creative writing in universities, especially in the UK, but I know here in the States as well. And people have this thirst to record their experience. And what I teach is narrative nonfiction or creative nonfiction. So it's a kind of in-between genre, which I actually fits writing about the sea very well because it's neither one thing nor the other. And I like it. I mean, I'm only part-time there, so it doesn't really have too much of a call on my time. But some of my students come up with extraordinary material, and I think this new way of writing, in a way, of using your personal experience, of using historical material, I speak to a lot of scientists, people like Stormy Mayo, a lot of scientists working with the sea. And what I see myself as kind of a conduit, a kind of way of passing on their information through me, through my imagination, and creating a narrative for it. And a lot of scientists, especially whale scientists, especially marine scientists now, have such an extraordinary story to tell because it's a changing world. I mean, changing in many ways for the worse, but also for the better in some ways. And they have stories to tell. And it's down to someone like me to be the kind of filter of that, to be a voice for them. And I know, you know, that the precepts of science are quite rigorous and quite restraining. And there are many ways that they cannot move into areas that anthropomorphize, that use emotion, mm-hmm. Which we writers can, broadcasters, mm-hmm. any artist, many people. And so that's... For me, that's the great power of writing like that.
You're curating an exhibition built around the themes of the book, Rising Tide, Falling Star, at the Albert Merola Gallery in Provincetown. So tell us more about the exhibition.
Well, it's really a tribute to Pat de Groot and her work. So there will be an entire wall of her cormorants there, but there'll be other works by John Waters, amazingly. Timothy Woodman, sadly, another wonderful artist who we lost past year. And many other artists, Paul Bowen, Misha Richter, local artists mostly, but showing internationally.
And it starts May 25th?
May 25th, you have an opening, 6 o'clock on May 25th, Albert Merola Gallery in Provincetown. Please come along.
And how long is it running?
Running till the 13th of June.
All right. We should mention that you're also giving an illustrated talk as part of the Center for Coastal Studies lecture series titled The Ocean Skin. That's happening May 30th at 7 p.m. in Provincetown. And we will have details about the exhibition. We'll talk as well more information about the latest book, Rising Tide, Falling Star, at our website, capeandislands.org. Less than a minute left, I wanted to ask you just your thoughts on the future of whales. I know it's only a minute, but they're in, no matter what species, there's a lot, it's tough out there.
It's a very tough story for the right whale. You look out into these waters around here and think, do they represent a mortal, our last experience, these extraordinary animals, maybe fewer as 400 left. Humpback whales doing really well. You know, mm-hmm. 10% more calves on the east coast of Australia. They're now appearing off the west coast of Ireland.
Good news there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So good and bad news.
Yeah. All right, Philip Hoare, author of Rising Tide, Falling Star, In Search of the Soul of the Sea. Thanks so much for taking time to visit with us. Appreciate having you here.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
And Dennis Minsky, thanks for bringing him down. Appreciate that.
You're very welcome.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.